Why you shouldn't treat dirt like dirt. Soil is something that we take for granted. While concerns about air and water garner front page attention in this age of climate change, lowly soil rarely gets its due. But researchers are sounding an alarm that we must take steps to protect and conserve the world's finite supplies of soil. And the effort can begin in our own backyard. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, we'll look at some of the jobs that soil does, quietly and reliably, beyond simply serving as a foundation for lawns and gardens and giving us a place to stand. And we'll look at some of the threats to the resource, what steps can be taken to assure that we have future supplies of earth on Earth. And we'll talk with a panel of experts about why the United Nations has declared this the International Year of Soils. First, this news. From the MPBN studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. Soil, it's something many of us probably don't spend too much time thinking about, but we probably should. Not only does it provide the foundation for much of the food we eat, it also helps to keep our water clean, our ecosystem diverse, and it can mitigate the effects of major storms. Today we're going to learn more about the many different types of soils, their importance to Maine and the world, and what can be done to protect this finite resource. Joining us from our Bangor studio, Natalie Lounsbury. She has a master's in soil science from the University of Maryland and has worked with farmers to develop cover crop-based strategies to reduce tillage in vegetable production. She is an Auburn native who's currently working on a podcast about soil health for farmers before going back to grad school. Ivan Fernandez is a professor of soil science at UMaine's School of Forest Resources and School of Food and Agriculture, as well as UMaine's Climate Change Institute. His research specializes in forest soils and critical issues such as climate change, acid deposition, and the effects of forest harvesting on the biochemistry of forests. Andrew Carpenter is founder of the Belfast-based company Northern Tilth. He's a master's in soil science from the University of Maine. And as always, we want to hear from you as well. What do you think of when you think of soil? Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. Again, that's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mpbn.net, and tweet at Maine Calling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Ivan Fernandez, let's start with you. I'm sure throughout your career, you have thought a lot about soil, its importance, the jobs that it quietly does beneath our feet, but many of us have not. Why is now the time to start thinking and being concerned about this resource?
Well, thanks, Keith, and thanks for the opportunity to talk about it today. It's really exciting to hear a show dedicated to soils and that discussion. The answer that came to my mind relatively quickly was population and the notion that on our planet, our population's 7 billion on its way to 9 or 10 billion, and we are increasingly intensively using resources. And so much of the particularly natural resources that we depend on, food, fiber, clean water, a suitable climate to live in, are a function of things that happen in the soil. And while it's underfoot and often out of sight, out of mind, many of the things that we value and prize really are strongly dependent on soil processes and soil functions. It's this thin veneer between the geologic substrate and the life on our planet with the atmosphere above.
And so, and we think of it as, I guess, infinite. You know, you think about all of the soil on the earth, but it is a finite resource. And as you put it, it's kind of like the earth's skin, and plays an important role, even though, as you say, we just sort of walk on it. But it is finite, right?
Oh, absolutely. And if we think about the land surface of the planet, and the thing we probably think first and foremost about, which is quite understandable, is food and food production. Probably 3/4 of the Earth's surface is not suitable to be used for food production. It's deserts, it's under ice, and then there's large, vast expanses, particularly the boreal and the tropical forests that the planet and we depend on by way of the various functions that those serve. So there's a small portion of the planet that we can use for food production, and half of that is already in food production and often being degraded. And beyond the part that's used, we go to increasingly less suitable land. And meanwhile, as I started with, our population and our demands on it are becoming increasingly intense. So soil is finite from the standpoint of soil providing specific services that the human species depends on.
And throw in climate change and its effects on weather and what we're seeing in the Central Valley of California. And then you have pressures to move some of that food production to other places as demand continues to go up.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we're rich with water. In fact, water precipitation amounts are increasing with the climate signal. So in the Northeast, we have a lot of natural resource advantages to utilize, but hopefully to utilize in a smart way and being mindful of the resources, including soils that process depends on, is critical and part of the reason we're all here talking about it today.
Natalie Lounsbury, so we've got it good here, at least for the moment in the Northeast, but some of this consciousness about soil and its importance can really happen in our own backyards and gardens. What's your take on how we should maybe rethink soil as individuals and what can we do to protect and conserve it?
Right. I think that one of the things is just recognizing that soil is living. There's tremendous diversity, biodiversity in the soil. And it's not just this substrate where you put inputs in and you get plants out. It's actually a functioning, living ecosystem. And so I think in the past, people maybe thought, oh, well, I'll just add a little nitrogen, add a little phosphorus, add a little potassium, and then you can grow plants. And that does work, but I think we're reaching a point where we recognize now that we need to focus more on soil health and encourage the microbial community in the soil and really think about it as a living system.
So even the word extinction has been passed around in reference to some of the background material I've read about soil, but the extinction here is really about these organisms and microorganisms that maybe because they're invisible, we don't pay much attention to, but they're in there, and what you're saying is that we need to protect them together as they depend upon each other to make soil do what it does.
Right. We need to encourage them to be able to do what they do. And that means maintaining a soil structure, maintaining the organic matter. You know, these organisms that are living in the soil require much the same things that we do. They require oxygen. They require food, which means organic carbon. So I don't know about extinction. I'm sure there's some of that going on. These soil microbes are actually very resilient, but we just need to give them the right conditions to thrive.
Yeah. Andrew Carpenter, tell us about what your company, which is based in Belfast, does and how it operates with solid waste agencies, et cetera.
Sure. Our mission really is to return organic matter-based byproducts to the soil to build fertility and soil health at the same time. And so as part of that, we work with a wide array of different byproducts. We work with manures from larger farms, food processing waste, biosols from wastewater treatment plants, also paper mill residuals, even seaweed processing byproducts. So, and our clients are also a wide array. In some cases, we work with the generators of those materials, industries and commercial operations and farms that are generating them. In some cases, organic waste recycling companies that need some technical expertise. We really specialize quite a bit in research and development with refining application rates, trying to make sure we're actually improving soil health and soil fertility while we're returning these materials to the soil. So that's kind of that's our passion. We do a lot of work with nowadays with larger farms. We develop nutrient management plans for large dairies and beef operations that are trying to make the most of the manure that they have, as opposed to just trying to sort of do what's easiest to do with it.
Right. So you're trying to do two things here. One is manage this waste, which we have to do something with, and I guess find a purpose for it, which in this case would be to fertilize land for agriculture. But there is a balancing act there, because you could actually be doing damage. And how complicated is that process? I mean, are we clear on how best to do this and what the risks are?
It can be incredibly complex. You know, certain materials are kind of no-brainers, and certain materials require quite a bit more upfront analysis to determine what they're good for and what they're not good for. Some of the programs that we work with are based on long-term risk assessments, looking at different contaminants that might be in there, making sure that when we're adding the material, we are improving soil health and not causing problems down the road. Some of them quite a bit easier to determine what they're good for and how to use them. So it can be complex. It can be relatively simple, but we do. It's the type of thing that we're much more adept at looking at now. There's a lot more information out there about what can be used to improve soil health and what things might cause long-term problems.
So, Ivan Fernandez, then what are the, I guess, the big issues here or threats that we need to pay attention to in terms of what we're doing, I guess, from a global perspective to soil? Is it deforestation? Is it clearing land for agriculture? I mean, what are the pressures?
Those are all good ones. The importance of conservation relative to limiting erosion is probably one of the major soil conservation concerns around the planet. And erosion's where water or wind removes the very top of the soil and blows or washes it away, which is happening in excess of the rate of soil formation in many parts of the world, including the United States. And the problem with that is the very best soil is right at the top, where most of the organic matter is, most of the nutrients. And so as you begin to erode at an accelerated rate, and I say that because some erosion is a natural process. Humans have a great capacity to accelerate the rate of erosion. And so when we do, we're losing the very best soil first, and that soil is full of the life that Natalie was talking about, and the nutrients and the organic matter that limits its ability then to provide the ecosystem services we depend on. And I say that purposely. It's not just producing food, which is paramount, but it's also storing carbon, which is balancing excess carbon going into the atmosphere. It's cleaning water as water percolates through soils. We depend on soils in order to both store and release at an appropriate rate fresh water and fresh water supplies, but also to filter and purify the water as it goes through the soil. And so maintaining the integrity of soils and not allowing accelerated erosion to occur is really critical. More locally, and that's kind of a global perspective, more locally, a lot of the concern has to do with knowing what our best soils are, knowing where they are, and having the technical information as we make decisions about land development and waste management with experts like Andrew, in order to be able to be smart in the development of areas that are growing, you know, Penobscot watershed and the Portland area, as well as in minimizing inputs to food production. Smart soil management maintains soil health, and we often talk about its sustainability, and minimizes the amount of inputs that we fossil fuel particular inputs that we need in order to grow food, And one of the problems with putting too much of even good things like nitrogen on soil is that it washes away. And the more rain we have, the more it's washing away. Right. And so, for example, some of it will go into surface waters and groundwater. It'll even go into the ocean. Some of the ocean acidification, nearshore ocean acidification we've heard about in the last couple of years is in part attributable to the nutrients washing out of the landscape.
Yeah.
And so using soil information in our decision making.
And Natalie, even simple what we accept, I guess, is sort of basic backyard gardening can have an effect. So you, first of all, you get your tiller out and you dig up, you know, the little patch that you're going to plant, and it's all nice and loose there. But even that has, you know, I guess, has an effect, right? The soil is loose. It can wash away the nutrients that are in there. It can become packed. What are some of the things that can happen from simple tilling? And can we improve the quality of the soil by planting by reducing the amount of that tillage that we do?
Right, yeah. So this happens on your backyard garden scale, but this also happens on a much larger scale on farms. In the last 3 decades or so, the average size of a tractor has increased 3 times. So we're using much larger equipment when we drive on the soil. And so we've got problems with compaction, which is just packing those soil particles together so that you don't have the airspace. When we think about soil, maybe we think about the actual minerals or the organic matter, but ideally, about half of that is actually air. And so a lot of these structural problems happen when we mess with the sort of the balance between the particles and the air and the organic matter. And so on a large scale, that happens with these large tractors. On a small scale, that happens when you go in with your tiller and you till up the soil, and maybe you're making the surface really light and fluffy, but you're actually compacting that subsoil layer. And so there are a lot of things that happen when you till. You also destroy aggregates, and aggregates are sort of the glue that holds the soil together, that keeps it from eroding. And when you destroy those and you expose that organic matter, it leads to a faster loss of organic matter. It can lead to things like soil crusting. If you have a garden or you have a farm and you've been out after rain and you see that crust on that soil, that's a sign of kind of an unhealthy soil with poor aggregate stability or aggregation. Tilling in general, it's funny because we have this aesthetic that goes back really thousands of years that we like to see a clean tilled soil. And I think in a lot of ways we need to change that.
And we'll talk we'll get into kind of how you do that. Because it's interesting, but we do need to take a quick break. And when we come back, we want to hear from you as well. Today's topic is soil, and this is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine Medical Center, getting people back to where they belong, home. Learn more at mainemedicalcenter.org. And Silly's in Portland's East End, open at 11 Tuesday through Friday and at 9 for brunch on the weekends, with vegan and gluten-free options. Sillies.com.
I told Watson, if I ever write a story myself, it will be to correct the myriad misconceptions created by his imaginative nonsense.
In the new film Mr. Holmes, Ian McKellen plays an aged Sherlock Holmes, now in retirement with a failing mind. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with McKellen about acting and about being closeted in England when it was a crime to admit being gay. Join us.
You can join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 here on MPBN. MPBN wants to capture the unique words, phrases, accents, and dialects of Maine. What were some of the Maine expressions you used or were around you growing up that you don't hear anywhere else? Do you know anyone who still has a unique Maine accent? You are invited and encouraged to record yourself, your aunt, grandmother, or neighbor for examples of unique Maine accents or dialects using your smartphone, tablet, or PC. Once you've done that, email the file to dialects@mpbn.net. To see our current interactive map of accents and regionalisms, and for more information, go to mpbn.net. Or you can go directly to mpbn.net/dialects. And thanks.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, why the United Nations declared this year the International Year of Soils. Joining us from our Bangor studio, Ivan Fernandez. He's a professor of soil science at UMaine. His research specializes in forest soils and critical issues such as climate change, acid deposition, and the effects of forest harvesting on the geochemistry of forests. Andrew Carpenter is founder of the Belfast-based company Northern Tilth, and he's a master's in soil science from the University of Maine. Natalie Lounsbury has worked with farmers to develop cover crop-based strategies to reduce tillage in vegetable production. And we invite you, as always, to join the conversation. The number is 800-399-3566. Email talk at mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Natalie, before the break, we were talking about ways to reduce tillage, essentially to be able to plant without necessarily doing that first step that we all know about, which is turning over your soil and digging it all up. How do you do that on a small scale?
Yeah, on a small scale, there are a lot of things you can do in a backyard garden. You can use cardboard and straw and stuff like that and sort of build these mulched raised beds. That doesn't work on a large scale. So on a large scale, it's much more difficult. And so in what we would call conventional systems, and I don't really like that word, but there's been advances in the last few decades with no-till agriculture where people just plant straight in, they don't till. The issue with this is that it does rely on herbicides. And so there's kind of this conundrum between, you know, saving the soil in terms of reducing erosion losses and using herbicides. In organic systems, it's much harder, but there are some cover crop-based strategies where we can reduce tillage by using these cover crops to create mulches and reduce weed pressure and just plant straight into those.
And so you have to choose carefully as to what kind of crops will grow in that kind of soil, that untilled soil?
That's a good question. People thought for a long time that, you know, small seeded things wouldn't work. And I actually have been doing some research and I use the smallest seeded things like carrots. And amazingly, it does depend on what kind of soil it is. You can't do this in really heavy clayey soils, but a lot of different crops can grow without tilling the soil. Sometimes they can be delayed because the soil tends to be a little bit cooler. But I think we're just sort of, still exploring what will grow without tillage, but it's a lot more than people thought.
All right, let's go to the phones here if we can. To Susan in Cape Elizabeth and David in Camden, you're next, but Susan first. Hi, Susan.
Oh, hi.
Hi. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I'm interested in hearing the panel's take on the usefulness and feasibility of something that I've been reading about, which is ancient practices of using something called biochar, which I understand is created by charring wood. And then I've read that it was used, say, in the Amazon to enhance the fertility of the soil, and that it might have a possibility of absorbing more carbon from the atmosphere. So my question is this something that we should hope will help us out, or is this just kind of a pipe dream?
Yeah. Who'd like that question?
This is Andrew from Northern Tilth. I'll take that. And Natalie and Ivan both might want to add to it. I have been looking into this issue and have worked with some materials that have biochar-like properties recently. And my overall take on it is there are some biochars out there that have properties that can be quite helpful for soil fertility. But it also seems to be the case that it's a very immature industry at this point. So there are... You will find a lot of biochars on the market, some of which can be great for soil fertility and some of which can actually not be helpful for soil fertility. And recently I've looked at a couple meta studies that have looked at hundreds of different published studies on biochar. And what you find is in terms of the balance between those that actually improve soil fertility and those that don't, it's pretty close. It's probably a little bit. Most of them improve them a little bit more, but a lot of them don't. I think it will mature. We'll learn more about it in the future, and we'll probably be making, I think you'll see more biochars out there. Right now, it's really a niche market. It's not done typically on a large scale because it's very expensive to actually create biochar. In the Amazon, the reason it came to pass was they tended to burn their crop residue, and over time they would get a char from that sort of low-temperature burning that over hundreds of years potentially built up a char layer in the soil. The sort of contemporary use of biochar is to make it by creating pyrolysis units, which is kind of a low temperature, low oxygen burn to create the biochar. It's a fairly expensive way to go. And a lot of the properties that you get from a biochar, you can get simply from adding compost and other organic amendments to soil. So I think in the long term, there may be I think the industry will mature and will probably get better biochars. Another thing about it, thermodynamically speaking, one promise of biochar is that you can actually, in a pyrolysis unit, in theory, you can derive energy from the organic matter, whatever biomass that you're subjecting to pyrolysis, in the form of you get both a syngas and an oil out of that process, and then you can use those to drive engines. In theory, or in practice, all of the pyrolysis units now that are being used to create a char as a soil amendment are really not harvesting that energy. So right now you're putting more energy into creating the biochar than you're getting out of the biomass that you put into it. Yep. If, I think, in the future, you could actually have pyrolysis units on a large scale that were making a biochar and in which you were actually capturing the energy in the form of the oil and the syngas, then I think that offers us the possibility of deriving energy from biomass and also capturing that carbon that's in the biomass and putting it into the soil.
Sorry to interrupt. Ivan or Natalie, do you want to add anything there?
I guess I'd just like to say that it's what part of what Andrew is saying is that it's largely dependent on the feedstock. And so I think that with a lot of things, it's like soil. Soil is not just soil. There's a huge diversity in soils. And same thing with biochar. It depends whether you're making biochar from wood or making it from chicken manure. So the jury's kind of still out, but I think it does hold some potential. But, you know, all biochars are different.
And so let me just add, biochar is not a magical substance. It's incompletely burned organic matter. And so many of us probably put a little biochar on our gardens when we throw out the wood ash from the stove because there's little chunks of wood that are incompletely combusted. In and of itself, it's a charcoal-like material. It's got a high surface area, so it can absorb lots of stuff. The problem is, Andrew did a great job describing the nature of trying to scale that up to sort of an industrial-scale product that's added. And so every time there's a fire, every time we put ash on a soil, we add a little bit of biochar, and biochar is in and of itself not a bad thing.
Sorry to interrupt you there, Andrew. I wanted to move us along, if we could, and get to David in Camden, who's been waiting patiently. Hi, David.
Hello. How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
I want to say thank you to the speakers there for taking time out of the busy day to answer questions. But I was wondering how we, the general public, could impress upon the university and schools in general the importance of soils and soil scientists so that it doesn't fall by the wayside and that we do address these important problems.
Yeah. Is the onus there on the universities to do that, or what's your sense as a group of the interest that I guess young scientists, young scholars have on this field of soil?
Well, they're looking at me, so let me start. So the challenge, of course, is it has to do with what's going on in society around us. It has to do with the 2007 crash as to how universities and institutions invest into the various disciplines. And I completely agree with the caller that soil science is a fundamental part, particularly a land-grant institution and throughout the country. Soil science as a discipline in support of agriculture and forestry and civil engineering and so forth is fundamental. However, as with society, the sort of charismatic nature of soils is not quite as much as wildlife and food and forestry, and so sometimes those factors influence which positions are refilled up to a point. And I think there's a swing of the pendulum that then reverses that when we get to a point where we don't have the critical mass to train adequately in the area of soil science. So it's directly linked to jobs in the private sector, but it also is critical to not lose the critical mass of knowledge in order to be able to train the next generation, which frankly is a problem at a number of land grants, including our own.
Okay, let's go ahead, Andrew.
This is Andrew. I'll add just a little to that. I think one thing that universities can do, and I know Ivan's very good at it. He was my advisor when I was at the University of Maine, is adapting to some of the changes that there are out there and jobs that are available for soil science. And I know just through my experience, I got training at the university in some of the more traditional forms of soil science, soil mapping and things like that. But I've found that in my business, a lot of working with organic waste has taken me on some tangents that are still related to soil science, but are not necessarily the type of soil science that you would learn at a university. So I think that universities could probably do a better job in some cases of seeing what's out there related to soil science, and in my case, the overlap of soil science and waste management, and developing programs that bring people in for those types of, you know, possibly newer jobs. I know, again, with my business has been growing in ways that I wouldn't necessarily have predicted based on what I was learning in school. A couple of things that have changed in the last couple of years is both Massachusetts, actually Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Vermont have initiated organic waste bans at landfills, which has meant that there's more organic waste going to composting and other types of processing than going back to the soil. Developing programs that help students prepare for jobs in that type of market could be quite helpful.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll go to Suzanne, who's waiting patiently in Franklin County. And again, the number 1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Casella, dedicated to improving air quality for all Mainers through a commitment to reduce its carbon footprint. Casella, giving resources new life. And Finance Authority of Maine, committed to expanding business and education opportunities by investing in Mainers' success. FameMaine.com.
Elephants and other African animals are facing extinction as criminal groups get into the illegal wildlife trade.
This is not just a threat to wildlife anymore. Increasingly, they say, you have terrorist and rebel groups capitalizing on this trade, and that's a threat to national security.
Poaching and terrorism, the race to protect wildlife and national security, next time on America Abroad.
That's coming up at the top of the hour at 1 o'clock here on MPBN. And on Thursday at 1.
Climate One is changing the conversation about energy, economy, and the environment. Our next program explores how the U.S. government is tackling the climate challenge. Both the Obama and the Bush administrations have faced the thorny question of how to promote economic and environmental health. And how can we bring the China powerhouse to the climate table? Join our host, Greg Dalton, for the next Climate One.
And that's coming on Thursday at 1 o'clock here on MPBN Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the importance of soil. Joining us from our Bangor studio Andrew Carpenter is founder of the Belfast-based company Northern Tilth, whose clients range from generators and processors of organic waste to recycling companies to farmers. Ivan Fernandez is a professor of soil science at UMaine, and Natalie Lounsbury has a master's in soil science from the University of Maryland and has worked with farmers to develop cover crop-based strategies to reduce tillage and vegetable production. Join the conversation. The number is 800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to the phones in a moment. But Ivan Fernandez, we haven't talked about the differences in soil types. There are many different types of soils. In fact, Maine has its own official soil type. Can you tell me about that?
Mic right now. There we go. Thank you.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
That's all right. When we're talking about soil, it's useful to mention that not all soil is the same by a long shot. There's 23,000 soil series, which is the name that we give to a soil at the practical level that we map them and utilize them. 119 soil types are in Maine. 87 were first identified in Maine. And so when a soil is first recognized and established, it's given a name, and the name usually represents the place or near the location where it was first identified. And so 87 were first established here, but can be found in other states. And then there's one state soil, official state soil, which is Chesuncook, which was established at the end of the 1990s, signed into law by then Governor King, and approved by the legislature. So these soils have different properties, and when we talk about using soils information and being mindful of soil characteristics and management and policy making, what we're talking about is digging into information about what soils are present, what are their properties, what are their characteristics, and how we can best utilize them. Back in the end of the 90s, when we established the state soil in Maine, there was probably like 14 states that had official state soils. Now many more do, and every state has identified its official state soil. And there's been a few years after we had established that, there was an effort to develop a soil exhibit highlighting soils from around the country. It was called Dig It, Secrets of the Soil. It was in the Smithsonian Institution, Smithsonian Museum in Washington, D.C. for a period of time, a couple of years. And now it's on tour in different places in the country. And our Chesuncook is one of the popular soils because of its interesting characteristics and layers.
All right, let's go to Franklin County, as promised. And Suzanne. Hi, Suzanne. Welcome to the program.
Hi. My comment is pretty unsophisticated, and I appreciate the fact that panelists are out there working in these fields and trying to communicate the importance of it to the rest of us. But I just think that in many of the states, there could be an advantage to working with the DOT or the other public transportation people. And I'm sure that they're aware that and there are a lot of training programs, all kinds of safety programs for state, employees. But I just think that it's really, it would be a great way to get the messaging across to people over time to have the best practices be taught and used by the people that the average person sees all the time. So maybe it wouldn't be the most important or, crucial things to be done to save soil, but I think it would be a great bridge for the public to become more aware of how soil should be treated and the variety of ways, and in turn some of the construction vehicles and the construction training that the DOT has, that they could be used without destruction, and also how all the byproducts of the different jobs that the state DOTs have to do, just one of the things you were talking about, the organic waste bans, there's just so much, and a lot of it is being done in small ways in state training programs, but some of them are optional, and there's not really much money or awareness, just gradually, as they repaint trucks and they redo signs, if there was some sort of an overall campaign that connected that made it educational and raised awareness that this is something that we all need and that it can be cared for better and that there's new things to learn and that kind of thing. The other thing is sometime maybe you want to talk about earthworms to the average person like me who used to think earthworms were a good sign in my soil. And I think also exhibits where kids have, where they have train exhibits and stuff, which are popular in Maine, be great to have made of the same kind of stuff, exhibits that showed erosion, because it's always such a surprise to see, even though you know, it's such a surprise to see how it happens.
Yeah, all right.
And so those are some of the suggestions I have to get the word out to, you know, to the rest of us, and graphs that show how much soil there really was in the whole world and how many people we have and you know, what that really means. Like somebody has a book that has all math things, like how many elephants it takes to make the state of Texas.
I'm sure that you guys have access to some of the stuff that Suzanne's talking about. But any comment on terms of, I guess, the general, I guess, the consciousness amongst, you know, as she mentions, DOT, but is there good awareness across government agencies about the impacts of projects?
Yeah, it's a good point, and I don't have enough information to comment specifically on a lot of that, but I do know that there is a new program and is a collaboration between DOT and the Maine Potato Board and some other folks to look at how to stop erosion from coming off the potato fields and getting into drainage ditches. Because this is a problem for farmers. They're losing their most valuable resource, which is soil. And it's a problem for DOT because they have to come and scoop out the ditches. So that's one comment on DOT. That's the only one I can really offer on that. But as for the next comment, which is earthworms, she makes a really interesting point. A lot of times earthworms are the soil life that we think about because they're very visible. And actually, Charles Darwin was one of the first to study earthworms and some really interesting work that he did. But in this part of the world, there were glaciers here not so long ago, 12, 15,000 years ago, and they scraped away the topsoil. And so the earthworms that we have here are actually considered invasive. And so if you have them in your garden, they can do a lot of great things. So it's, you know, it's not to say, oh, you should eradicate the earthworms from your garden, but they're not actually, natural residents of forest ecosystems in this area. And Ivan may have more to say about that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I never knew that. When we are always gardening, we pull it up and, you know, the conventional wisdom is to my kids, it's like, oh, look, they're doing their work. Aren't they great? But,
Which is exactly the case, and in our lawns and in our gardens, we're absolutely right if we say earthworms are great. They're helping us. They're part of that living biome underground. But as Natalie pointed out, the glaciers came along, scraped away the material, put new material down, and through much of Maine, particularly in coniferous forests, so we don't have earthworms. So as earthworms invade, become part of those ecosystems that they have not been part of, they radically speed up how fast organic matter decomposes, which we've talked about in a number of contexts, and it's the same in the soil. We want some decomposition, but we don't want it too fast. Otherwise, we won't have the forests that we know around us. And actually, that example of fishing is one of the primary ways that earthworms invade the landscape, as we all recreationally bring earthworms into that landscape, dump the extras behind us when we're on our way out, and allows them to invade. So in Maine, we don't have a severe problem yet, but there is examples where earthworms are now in areas, forested areas, where they were not before. And in other states, in southern New England and the Atlantic states, it's a very severe problem. Okay. So in that context, it's not a good thing.
Yeah.
In your garden and front lawn, it's great.
Right. Okay, great. Let's go to Richard in Standish. Hi, Richard.
Oh, hello. I've learned more in the last half hour than I have. I've been organic gardening for 30 years. I have a very simple question. You talked about rototilling before. And I've wavered back and forth over the years between using my spade fork and my rototiller. But what about when you've planted a cover crop, using the rototiller to dig that stuff in?
Natalie?
I guess that's me.
That's you.
Yeah, so when you use a cover crop, sometimes cover crops can be hard to kill. It depends at what stage of growth they're at. So one thing that I actually have started to do a lot, we do have a small farm, is we use a lot of winter-killed cover crops. So they just naturally die, and then we don't have to worry about turning them in. That's not to say that the overwintering cover crops are bad. They do a lot of great things, but they can be harder to kill. And so unless you're choosing to use herbicides, sometimes to get them to die and plant your garden, you do have to till.
Okay, Richard?
Well, thank you.
All right, good luck. Thanks for calling in. Let's go to Lou in Guilford. Hi, Lou.
Yes.
Yes, go ahead, please.
Thank you for taking my call. I really appreciate it. As a farmer and having come from a planting background in the Midwest, we used to have a program that was promoted by USDA called LESA, Land Evaluation and Site Assessment, which was a great planning tool. And it basically informed the community and the applicants to look at the appropriateness of development and future guidance and comprehensive plans based on soil types and their importance. And I wanted to know if there's anything like that in existence today, and is anything being done to further that in the planning process?
Who'd like that?
I'll take that first. I don't know of anything specifically like LESA. There is the NRCS, as a lot of you probably know, it's published soil surveys that identify all the different soil series down to a pretty good level of precision across the country and including in Maine. And those maps are often used for planning purposes. I don't know of anything, like I say, specific like this LESA program. It is the case that those soil surveys are updated from time to time. And in my work, I often go out to sometimes confirm whether or not those maps are good, and if not, identify where they're not and make planning changes accordingly. But what I've found is they are they're pretty good. They're pretty precise. The NRCS has done, I think, a very good job of, on a broad scale, identifying soil properties, certainly throughout Maine and I think throughout the country.
So what are
Go ahead. Let me I just would add there that none of the people on the panel are really working for a federal agency, and I know that there's a number of programs and tools that that address some of the kind of planning concerns that the caller raised. Particularly Natural Resource Conservation Service and other branches of USDA. So there is a lot of resources available. There's more resources available online on the web. Andrew mentioned the soil survey. I just wanted to add that there's now web soil survey, which is exactly what it sounds like. You can go to the web and cut out the area of land that you're interested in and get soil information, soil maps, and interpretations. And so the ability to use this kind of information has never been easier and more at our fingertips, us being everyone, the public and professionals alike.
Yeah. Where do you find that?
If you just Google web soil survey, you'll get to it. I don't remember the exact URL.
Gotcha. Okay, good. Thank you.
Sure.
Let's try, let's see here. Let's go quickly to Heidi in Medford. Hi, Heidi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. We've got about a minute left, so real quickly,
okay.
If you could.
What I'm going to do is put in a plug for the conservation throughout the state of Maine, doing great job. I specifically support Escambia County Soil and Water Conservation District. They are on a local level, have classes available to people that are just more interested in what they can do locally within their own property with their soil and water. And that's all I wanted to say, is that if people have questions, farming, or anything like that, they want to put a culvert in, totally support the Soil and Water Conservation District at the county level. Thank you very much.
All right, Heidi, thanks.
Yeah, that's a great comment from your caller. Right, absolutely right.
So with literally 30 seconds left here or so, any other guidance as to where people who listen today want to learn more about soil and you know, how to conserve and protect it? Is there one or two sites that you'd recommend?
Well, Soil and Water Conservation Districts, the Natural Resource Conservation Service on the web will lead you to a lot of resources. I don't know whether.
And the Soil Science Society of America is a great resource.
And in Maine, we have a Maine Association of Professional Soil Scientists, which has a website that gives you access to folks that are often licensed soil scientists in the state of Maine.
All right.
I'll put in a plug for Natalie, too, who's working on a podcast on soil health now that will be coming out shortly.
Right. Coming out soon.
And also, there is an organization specific to residuals recycling called the Northeast Biosolids and Residuals Association that has a lot of information on different residuals and how they're used as soil amendments.
All right.
I think it's nebiosolids.org.
Excellent. Natalie, Ivan, Andrew, thank you all for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having us.
Natalie Lounsbury, master's in soil science, rather, from the University of Maryland, and has worked with farmers to develop cover crop-based strategies to reduce tillage in vegetable production. She's an Auburn native, currently working on a podcast, as we just mentioned, about soil health for farmers. And Ivan Fernandez is a professor of soil science at UMaine's School of Forest Resources and School of Food and Agriculture, as well as Maine's Climate Change Institute, and Andrew Carpenter, founder of the Belfast-based company Northern Tilth, and he has a master's in soil science from the University of Maine. Nikki Shields ran the board today. Our volunteer Tommy Bazarian answered your calls. We had additional technical help from Rich Tozier. The executive producer of Maine Calling is Jonathan Smith. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.